I love that cartoon strip, Peanuts, and that adorable pup named Snoopy. In one episode, Snoopy is seen lying in his doghouse, talking to himself, waxing philosophical. Sometimes he says, "I lie awake at night wondering why I was born, why I was put on this earth. What am I doing here?" And then suddenly it hits me. I don't have the slightest idea. There are churches that bump along doing what they've always done without ever really grappling with that question. Doing things because they've always done them the way they have been done. What is it really that we are to be about? And what lies beneath that question is just as important a question. Who are we anyway? And how does that inspire us and pull us forward into mission ministry? You may remember that scene in Alice in Wonderland where that precocious and quite self-assured Alice, the soul of rationality, a sensible, well-put-together young girl, is confronted by the caterpillar on the toadstool and is asked in tones of condescension, "Who are you?" And Alice reflects, "This is not an encouraging opening for a conversation. I hardly know, sir, just at the present moment. I wonder if I've changed in the night. Let me think. Was I the same when I got up this morning? I almost think I can remember feeling a little different. But if I'm not the same, then the next question is, who in the world am I?" That, she says, is the great puzzle. Indeed, that is the great puzzle that you and I are called to solve, both individually and corporately, during this interim time, during this time of transition. This is a fundamental question that we must ask ourselves. Who are we? And what do we know to be true about ourselves? And what is our church like, really? I mean, what is the distinguishing characteristic, the spiritual DNA that makes our church look and feel different from the church just down the road? How do we understand ourselves, and what does that self-awareness lead us to do? When I ask people what church they attend, and then after they tell me to describe in one phrase what distinguishes their church from others, I get typically a whole range of answers. People will say, "Oh, we're a friendly church." Well, I hate to tell you, but every church that I have been a part of, when they describe themselves as friendly, whether they're friendly or not, everybody thinks they're friendly. Or they may say that they're a mission-minded church, or a Bible-believing church, or an active congregation. They may mention their programs or their ministries or their staff or their budget. They may talk about how they spend their money or how they spend their time or how big or how small their church is or how they do worship. Even the things that they hope for actually have something to do with this thing called identity, this question that we ask ourselves. Who are we? That, after all, is the question of identity. Even when our children are small and we ask them what they want to be when they grow up, their answers tell us something about who that child is and what's important to that child. So a church's hopes for its future, along with its past history and its present realities, all combine together to answer the question of identity. And that's the second mark of a healthy congregation: being certain, being clear about who we are and what our mission might be. During this time of transition in your church, one of the tasks that squarely falls on you is to become more and more conscious of who you are. Yes, you are a congregation that shares 1,000 characteristics with other congregations. But there are certain things that make you unique. If a new neighbor were to ask you if they were looking for a church home, what are some of the characteristics about your congregation that you can tell me? What would you say to them? Or for that matter, when a pastor search committee begins its work trying to find a new pastor, invariably, if the pastor is worth his salt, is going to ask the question, well, tell me something about your church. What is your identity? Who are you? What kind of church are you? And you can say, hopefully with confidence to that person, well, we are this kind of church, or we're not that kind of church. You might say, well, we're a Baptist church. After all, that's on the name, right? Out on the marquee in front of the church, First Baptist Church, Clemens. Well, someone may say, well, what kind of Baptist are you? There's Southern Baptist, Cooperative Baptist, Independent Baptist, Landmark Baptist, Primitive Baptist, Conservative Baptist, Liberal Baptist, Moderate Baptist. There are High Baptists and Low Baptists and everything in between. What would you say to someone who was asking the question, what's the distinguishing mark of Clemens First Baptist Church? And the way that you use words to describe yourselves paints a picture of how you see your identity. It's so important to know who you are and to be comfortable in your own skin with who you are. One of the churches that I served years ago was in a small industrial town about 6 miles from another small university town, the Shenandoah Valley of Virginia. There was sort of an informal rivalry between the two communities, and the locals would describe their two communities in this way. In Lexington, they said, when folks go to work, they carry a briefcase. In Buena Vista, when folks go to work, they carry a lunchbox. Now, what does that tell you about the communities, the two communities? The one community is academic. The other community, blue collar, maybe factory workers. And so when I heard that story, it told me volumes about the kind of community that I served. I served in that small community that was more industrial. And when I listened to people tell stories about themselves, I always had a sense that they had a lower self-esteem because, after all, those folks over in the college town had a higher opinion of themselves than they ought. And so I said to my folks in my church, why don't you just stop worrying about what those other folks think? Why don't you just kind of be comfortable in your own skin? I told them there was nothing to be sorry about, nothing shameful about being a blue-collar church, and there's nothing wrong with being a white-collar academic university church either. You are who you are. So just celebrate that. And just begin to let your understanding of yourself inform what you do as a church, kind of programs, the kind of ministries and emphases that you plan. Knowing who you are gives you greater confidence in carrying out the mission that God may have entrusted to you. Gives greater resilience as we move through the wrenching changes that may cause stress and distress at the deepest level of congregational identity. Getting clear about who we are, understanding our congregation's values, understanding our history, our culture, its unique strengths and challenges. This is the glue that holds us together. This is what inspires us and pulls us forward in ministry. Jesus knew who he was. In our scripture reading earlier, you may remember that Jesus had just come up from out of the water from his own baptism, where everyone present had seen the skies break open, and they watched as the dove descended out of the heavens, and they heard a voice from heaven that introduced Jesus as God's own Son, in whom he was well pleased. After something like this, everyone that was there, including maybe even Jesus himself, might have expected to sprout wings and for him to sprout wings and to fly away. They might have looked at him as some kind of superhero who would cease to be human in order to rescue human beings, showing up at the nick of time to snatch them out of danger. Only that's not what happened. What happened was that he went from that one spectacular moment to a long and lonely time out in the wilderness, during which he may have wondered if he had imagined the whole thing at the Jordan River. For 40 days and for 40 nights, there was no sight of God. The skies did not open. There was no sign of God at all. There were no doves. There were no voices, no reassuring words that came out of heaven. There was only Jesus and the desert, and finally, the devil himself. You probably know the conversation by heart now, so I won't go over it all again. The most important thing to notice is that what was on the devil's test of Jesus, what his temptation was really all about. First of all, he tempted Jesus to practice magic. Command that these stones be turned into loaves of bread. Next, he tempted Jesus to call on God for special protection. Throw yourself down from the pinnacle of the temple, he said, and the angels will come to your protection. And finally, he tempted him to take control of all the kingdoms of the world. All of these things I will give unto you, he said, if you will only bow down and worship me. All along, the devil suggested that Jesus deserved better than what God was giving to him. Well, why should the Son of God be famished and be hungry? Why should he even so much as stub his toe or be subject to Caesar when Caesar should be subject to him? If God could not do better than that with his own son, then maybe, just maybe, he was suggesting Jesus should start around looking around for another God. Listen to how the devil begins two of his three tests. If you are the Son of God, better translation of that would be, since you are the Son of God. He's daring Jesus to prove that he is God by acting like a God. If he's not really tempted by that idea, then this is really not a test at all. It's only a test if he is sorely tempted to rise above the hunger and the danger and the helplessness of the human condition and seize something better for himself, to make himself a good meal since he was so hungry, or to whistle up some angel bodyguards, or to start planning his own inauguration as president of the whole world. He is the Son of God, after all. This is a story in which everyone finds out what being the Son of God really means. This is a story in which Jesus proves who he is, not by seizing power, but by turning it down. God's beloved will not practice magic. He will not ask for special protection or even political power. As much as it may surprise everyone, including perhaps even Jesus himself, he will remain human, accepting all the usual risks. He will be comfortable in his own skin, doing the very thing that God sent him into the world to do, and nothing less. As Barbara Brown Taylor says, this is, after all, the only way humans will ever learn what Son of God really means. A Son of God is not someone who is related to God by rising out of his humanity, but someone who is beloved by God for sinking into it, even when he is famished, even when he is taunted by the devil himself. It is someone who can listen to every good reason in the world for becoming God's rival and remain God's child instead. The story of Jesus' time in the wilderness is primarily a story about Jesus' identity. But since you and I are related to him, since we are belonging to him, it is also a story about our own identity too. For there will be plenty of times when we're tempted to believe that we deserve bigger and better than we already have. And there will be plenty of times when we'll look at others and wish that we had what they had, or wish that we were what they were. Or there'll be devilish voice inside of our head that says things like, if you were a child of God, shouldn't things be going a little smoother for you? If you're really a Christian, I mean, shouldn't you be happier or healthier or richer or safer? And if your church were really the church that God wanted you to be, then wouldn't you be growing by leaps and bounds, building bigger and better budgets and buildings? What's wrong with you? And when we hear that voice inside our heads, we know what to say because of what Jesus said. Away from you, Satan. Away from me, Satan. I would rather be a hungry child of God than a well-fed player on your team. Get behind me, Satan. And if we can manage that, then chances are pretty good that we'll hear the voice of God, the voice coming to us from heaven, saying to us, just as it did that day on the banks of the Jordan River, you are my beloved child, you are my chosen people, and you, I am well pleased. What are the marks of a healthy church? Community that's authentic. We talked about that last week, to be sure. It's important that we become a place where people will feel welcome, that we are able to offer to the world what they desperately need, a place to belong, a place to love and be loved, a place to be real. But just as important for us to know is for us to know what kind of community we are, to be clear about who we are and whose we are and why we're here. And so for that reason, I've asked you to take that card that you took out of the offering plate today and to jot down on it a word or two or three, whatever it is that you may choose. If a person were to come to you and say to you, of all the churches in Clemens, North Carolina, of all the churches that I might attend if I were to choose to attend your church, what is it that distinguishes your church? What is the distinctive mark or quality of Clemens First Baptist Church? What would you say? What would you say to a prospective pastor? If a pastor were to say, would you describe for me in one word or even in a phrase, what is it about Clemens First Baptist Church that's so special? If you would just take the time while we spend a few moments in reflection and meditation to jot down on that card what you would say. And after you've done that, we'll have a time of prayer just to pray that God will reveal to us exactly what it is that He wants to show us about ourselves, who we are, and what He's calling us to do and to be. So would you just spend some time in quiet reflection and meditation right now as you write down your answer to that question of identity? Who are we? And what is it that makes our church so special?